In the U.S. today, Subway has about 20,000 U.S. store locations and 3,000 in Canada, and it spans 54 states and territories. The total worldwide is 37,000 of the Subway stores. 3 months ago, the company announced that it is out in the world exploring a sale that could value that business at as much as $10 billion. Now, before he signed on to Subway 2 years ago in May of 2021, Dana was the Executive Vice President of Digital and the CIO for the $4 billion restaurant chain Bloomin' Brands, where he oversaw global strategy, development, and implementation of IT and digital consumer initiatives. Before Bloomin' Brands, he was CIO and Senior Vice President of E-commerce at Avon Products, the global beauty company, where he created the Avon's first digital center of excellence and then built out its global e-commerce platform. And then before Avon, he was the very first CIO at Wrigley, the global confectionery company, where his IT leadership duties also encompassed VP of supply chain strategy and planning. So all of that adds up to one of the many reasons why in 2016, Dana was inducted into CIO Magazine's CIO Hall of Fame. Dana, welcome. It's so nice to have you here today.
So nice to see you again, Mary Fran, and lovely to join you. Let me also thank you on behalf of myself, but also all of my peers as technology leaders for your support for us. Your advocacy, your reporting, your studying of our profession. You've helped us elevate our game, so thank you.
Well, you're so welcome, and I'm so taken aback because I feel like it's the whole crew at CIO.com and CIO Magazine. There's this mass of people behind me that have been cheerleaders and advocates for CIOs for as pretty much as long as I can remember at this point. But that's very lovely of you to say. Now, let's start with the big picture industry trends. I often launch off with this 30,000-foot view of the industry, and we know that the restaurant business especially suffered a lot of lingering impacts from the pandemic, including labor shortages and the accelerating digital expectations and demands from customers. So let's start talking about that, about how that has affected Subway.
Well, I mean, the industry, I've been working in the restaurant industry for nearly 10 years now. And when I joined the industry, I think it was fair to say the decade of digital transformation in the restaurant industry, which would have been 2010 onwards. Some restaurant brands went after it. You can think in terms of, say, Domino's as a leader in terms of digital access and convenience, delivery. You can think of a Starbucks as a leader in terms of using customer data to really drive relevance in terms of marketing and messaging and rewards and loyalty. But the industry was a little bit split, and especially around this whole topic of dining outside the restaurant, having food delivered to the home or the office, or people even coming to collect it and drive it home themselves. Some brands felt, well, that's not a great experience. We're about the ambiance in the restaurant. We're about, hot food being delivered in perfect condition to the guest in the restaurant. People should eat in a restaurant. And so some brands didn't really lean into digital transformation. Some brands did, and the industry's kind of split. And then the pandemic came along, and I think the argument was settled by the pandemic that regardless of the nature of your restaurant brand, regardless of the nature of your food, if you couldn't deliver it, and if you couldn't have contactless ordering, payment, delivery, curbside takeaway, you were out of business. Subway was no different. I think the Subway context that was a little bit specific to Subway was those 2010s were also a period where the Subway brand in general drifted a little bit, not just in terms of digital, but really just in terms of the overall business. Our founder became ill, and there wasn't a succession plan really in place. When he passed away, there was a series of leadership changes. you know, interim CEOs, and right up till 2019, when, you know, the new leadership team at Subway was assembled by our CEO, John Chidsey, Subway kind of drifted because its own leadership and its own strategy was impacted by some of these leadership changes. So, you know, we were starting from a different point, perhaps to some others, in terms of digital transformation, but with that urgency driven by the pandemic. And so, you know, we tell people today a little bit of Subway history. When the new team first got here in 2019, if we drove traffic to our app and our website for, you know, digital ordering, at about 3% of sales, they would crash. We just couldn't scale the infrastructure. The user experience was not tremendous. We had a relatively small digital business. And during the pandemic, we really had to address that. And I'm sure we'll talk more about that later. And so that's one area. Digital transformation is something we're all preoccupied with. Another area, and you hit on it as well in the intro, is labor, especially in the restaurant industry, is an increasing issue. It's a pretty labor intensive industry.
Yes.
You know, wage inflation has been going on at a pace before the pandemic. A fair living wage has been, you know, in legislation in a lot of states before the pandemic. And then the pandemic comes along and we suddenly lose labor in our restaurants. In fact, to this day, even as we've emerged very, very successfully from the pandemic, our operating hours for our Subway restaurants are still down about 8% versus pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
And so that's a headwind on revenue, clearly. And that's driven by labor availability. And then, of course, as a CIO, pre-pandemic, we had challenges with talent and the war for talent. And, you know, during and post-pandemic, it became much more difficult. You know, somewhere like Subway in Milford, Connecticut, which is where I am today, we have two headquarters now, one in Miami and the one in Connecticut. In Milford, Connecticut, we weren't competing with a lot of other big companies for talent in this area, Connecticut. And then the pandemic comes along and people can work from their home office. They don't need to commute to Boston or New York or Hartford, Connecticut. We suddenly have a different competitive set going after our talent. So, you know, a lot changing, but fun times, and, you know, especially in the restaurant industry, which should be a fun industry anyway, really putting digital at the center of the growth strategies is really fun for our tech team.
Well, I remember having conversations like this with you, this was pre-pandemic, but when you were with Bloomin' Brands, there were strategies that you and the other leaders were talking about that would, you know, increase the ability to deliver and to build out that kind of service. Yeah. And there's always such resistance to change from a model that seems to be working great.
Yeah.
And I always think of that Dilbert cartoon of him where he's saying, you know, change is good. You go first.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly.
And Subway had actually started its digital platform refresh back in 2019. And at that point, you were leaving. I guess you thought you were going to go golfing and kind of hang out and drive your boat around and that sort of thing. But you got pulled back in to work on this enormous multi-year business transformation going on at Subway. So I want you to talk about what it was about this brand and all the challenges it was facing that got you back in the game.
I actually do love change and transformation, although as a human being, I'm not necessarily loving it when it happens to me, but I do love to be part of that, creating something new. I'd retired from Bloomin' Brands and we'd gotten to a point and you know, I'm proud of the work the team there did. We had actually hired people who had worked on the Domino's tech platform for delivery, and we built out our own tech platform and our own operating platform, our own drivers and our own fleet, etc. Pre-pandemic, when it was not common for full-service dining brands to really be all in on delivery, it clearly, if you talk to Bloomin' Brands today, they'd say that you know, that saved them. They didn't furlough or let go of any staff during the pandemic because they were able to keep about 70% of their business by being essentially 100% a delivery company during that period
where
restaurants were shut. But I had retired at the beginning of 2020, literally before the pandemic, with big plans. I grew up in Ireland. I wanted to spend a little bit more time there with family and friends in Ireland. I wanted to travel. I felt that at Bloomin' Brands, we'd gotten to the point where I'd made the impact I could have. Mm-hmm. And so I left and, you know, I got into angel investing, joined a group in Florida. Mm-hmm. I got into nonprofit work with a education nonprofit. But I'm one of those people who, if, you know, when I open my calendar on a Sunday evening, if I don't see a lot of things during the week, I get anxious. You know, I have that sense of kind of being productive, having a purpose. And so, you know, about a year into my retirement, John Chidsey, the CEO of Subway, who I didn't know at the time, but I had a mutual friend who had joined Subway and suggested we meet. And John actually flew down to St. Petersburg, where I live. Friday night, we sat there in my backyard and we had a couple of drinks, smoked a cigar and talked a lot. And, you know, he got me interested enough that I wanted to help him find someone to do this job, but I didn't at that point want to do it myself. But, you know, to help him find the right person, I wanted to meet the rest of the leadership team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after I met the rest of the leadership team, I was just sucked in because the opportunity was great. You know, there's an expression, people say happiness is a low base. Well, you know, having had a decade adrift and then the impact of the pandemic, Subway was ripe for a refresh. And I could just see that the strategies were going to work. The question is, could we execute together as a team? And so I decided to go back in.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know that your very first focus when you got there was to stabilize the team because there had been a lot of outsourcing and then there's the second wave of downsourcing. So you came into a situation where 30% of the positions were open and the team was, at, you know, at kind of a 70-30. What was good about, what was good and bad about that, about coming in and finding so many open positions that I suspect you saw that as more opportunity to bring about the change you need that the company.
Yeah, I mean, it, look, it was for sure it was short-term pain. The team, as you say, you know, there had been an outsourcing initiative that had, you know, always there's a level of disruption there.
Yes.
And you know, friends leave, and the team that remains has emotion about that. Then there was a restructuring as part of the new leadership coming into Subway to reset the operating model of the company. And so, you know, that had a couple of years of massive uncertainty and then, you know, some change which could have been perceived as negative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so the team was, I think, skeptical. Number
Fair
one,
enough,
they were skeptical about the future of the company. We as a new leadership team had no credibility yet. We were new. We could say things, but the question was, would we do them? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so my first job was stabilizing that organization. And when I got here, one thing I was able to do fairly quickly was, okay, I can't fill 30% of open positions overnight, but I can reset the workload to be reasonable for the size of the team we had. And, you know, I got here, we had 92 projects and we went through all the projects. I remember we spent 2 days grinding through them. And at the end of it, we'd assessed that we should kill about 60 of the 92. Mm-hmm. And so I had to go back to our leadership team and say, look, honestly, there's been a lot of eagerness to please among the team. They're accepting challenges that they and commitments that they can't really deliver on. Let's reset and refocus and help these people get, you know, some balance, because there was a lot of stop start, you know, start a project, do it for 6 months, put it on the shelf, pick up something else. Things were not getting finished. And so we just reset priorities. We got the executive leadership team engaged. We said from now on, any investment has to have an executive leadership team sponsor. Mm-hmm. And you've got to come to us with the business case. I'm not going to make the business case for you to the rest of the leadership team. Yeah. If you have a marketing initiative, or if you have an operations initiative, or you have a finance initiative, bring it to the whole ELT, justify it to us collectively, and collectively we'll allocate resources to it. Mm-hmm. And so the team initially then got a period of relief where it was like, oh, good, we're going to focus on a smaller number of initiatives. We can put more intensity into it. We can deliver, finish some things, get some credibility with the new leadership team. And then in the meantime, we brought on board a couple of people to do full-time recruiting and just basically have our own talent acquisition group to go after aggressively filling positions and compromising on location, as we all did. Mm-hmm. So, you know, about a third of our team now works remotely, and they're scattered all over this country. So that's a different model.
Yeah, and
which emerged from the pandemic.
And you would expect that to continue in all likelihood.
I do.
Yeah.
I do. It's obviously got, you know, moving as fast as we are, transforming Subway, you know, running at 100 miles an hour, changing culture, bringing in a lot of new people, changing the business model. There are disadvantages to us being remote, but the advantages, we get top talent from anywhere in the country. So we just have to be realistic about the trade-offs there.
Yes, I can totally see that. And speaking, and it's actually making me think how adaptable and flexible CIOs, the CIO Hall of Famers especially, always have to be, because things change and of course stuff happens with technology. And speaking of that, when we queued up our show right at the beginning, we were talking about how this is a live show and not pre-recorded. And it turns out the first 90 seconds, there was a problem with audio. So I got a note from our producer asking if I could just do a little a rerun on the intro once more. So if you'll bear with me here, I will once again remind the audience that, and it's all working well now, that we're streaming live on LinkedIn and to our CIO channel on YouTube, and that we do welcome our viewers to join the conversation with Donna and type your questions into the chat window. And I also wanted to mention again that today's episode is sponsored by Topdesk, which is a leading provider of IT service management software. It's a flexible and affordable service desk software designed to grow with its customers to help you simplify, scale, and integrate multiple departments in one place. And then after that commercial break, we are back to our questions. Now, in the intro after that, I mentioned that Subway announced a few months ago that it is seeking a buyer. So you're selling the company. And as you sell it as the chief digital and information officer, you're pretty deeply involved in that whole process. What can you tell us about that?
Well, first of all, why are we selling? So Subway was founded actually in Bridgeport, Connecticut, down the road from where I'm sitting today, over 50 years ago, by Fred DeLuca, who mm-hmm. you know, the DeLuca family ended up owning 50% of the brand. And then the investor, Dr. Peter Buck, who was Fred mm-hmm. DeLuca's partner and put up the money for the first sandwich store, his family owned the other 50%. Fred DeLuca died, as I mentioned earlier, in around 2014, 2015 timeframe. Mm-hmm. Dr. Peter Buck died about a year ago. And so with the two founders having passed on, the two families being very supportive, but not, you know, engaged in operating the business or running the business.
Right.
You know, the feeling of the families, the feeling of our board of directors was, it would be good to bring in new owners to take us mm-hmm. through the next period of growth and investment into the company, because we have a massive opportunity to still grow this brand around the world. And so with that said, we announced that we were basically putting the company up for sale about 3 months ago, as you say, we've had tremendous interest. You know, we've worked on 5 strategies to turn around the company, better food. I'll talk about them maybe later.
Right, yes, but, I've got it.
You know, clearly as a restaurant company, you got to innovate on your food and your menu. You've got to have consistent operations and service mm-hmm. excellence in the restaurants. We're a value player, as are many quick serve restaurant brands. So you mm-hmm. got to stay value and affordable. You need modern and appealing physical restaurants. So you need to develop and refresh your restaurants. And then digital access, the digital revolution, as we call it here at Subway, you know, on all of those strategies, we've made measurable progress. And so, mm-hmm. you know, as we put the information together for prospective buyers, everybody's very interested. So we've had about 10 private equity companies express interest. We as a leadership team have met with all of them, mm-hmm. spent a full day with each, presenting, you know, our strategies, our progress, our prospects for the future. Yeah. They're very interested in the role of technology and digital as, mm-hmm. you know, a growth layer. There's multiple growth strategies within that. And you know, as a CIO, you start to think a little bit differently. So, for example, mm-hmm. as is the case with many, you know, franchise companies, we charge our franchisees a fee for the technology we provide. And so, you know, to that extent, our feet are held to the fire by the people who pay our bills. Yeah. And, you know, you think of that technology fee as a CIO, as, you know, that's a source of operating expense that I can invest in tech. But when you then start to look at how investors value a company and you start thinking, well, you know, that tech fee is, you know, let's say that tech fee in our case is pays only a small portion of our technology expense, the brand spends most of or funds most of it for the franchisees. That tech fee brings in $30 million a year. Well, let's say at a 15 multiple, $30 million, which is can hit the bottom line, is worth $450 million of value or market cap.
Ah,
and
okay.
So you start to think also not just about operating expense or income, but you're thinking about, well, every dollar, when I have a 15 or a 20 multiple on it, it's dimensionally a different thought process as to how you spend your money.
Okay. Well, and this is an ideal moment then to pivot in and talk a little bit more about the technology team that you have built yeah. and are probably constantly building. I don't think I've ever yeah. talked to a CIO who sits back and says, oh, we're good. We got all the talent yeah. we need. Yeah. In fact, it's one of the big drivers that convinces CIOs like yourself to come on the show and talk about, because you might not look at the company from the outside and think, what a cool place to work in technology. Yeah. So that's yeah. always a big driver for the CIOs who come on as guests. So let's talk about the size and scope of the tech team and also how you've structured it to deliver more value to the business. Because I know yeah. one of the things that has always marked your career is the impact that you have on working with your technology teams. I mean, you're a very you're a nurturing kind of boss. You're as interested in how people will move forward in their careers as you possibly can be. So that has to be one of the big reasons why people stay and also why they join. So talk about the scope and size of the team and how you have it structured now. What kind of things you changed?
Yeah, it's interesting. So we have about a little over 200 internal tech team members and about 1,000 external tech team members from 2 outsourced partners in India,
yeah.
Capgemini and HCL. You know, of our internal tech team, those 200 odd positions, about 50% of them are new to Subway in the last 3 years. So we've had a massive infusion of new talent, new experiences, new perspectives. Yeah. About 25% are, you know, between 3 and 10 years, and 25% of them are 10 years plus. So we've a yeah. blend of long tenured, really good, engaged people with a lot of institutional knowledge, who know the Subway way extremely well and deeply.
Yes.
And then a nice blend of people who've come from a whole bunch of different industries, you know, mainly retail and hospitality, but a bunch of industries right. who yeah. bring different perspectives, different experiences. It makes us a stronger, more diverse team. Mm-hmm. So I feel really, really good about that. And then, you know, I think mindset and culture are more important than structure, Mary Fran, but structure, while it doesn't deliver results, it can get in the way of results. And yeah. so, you know, my predecessor, and I understand, and I've talked to him about why he did it, and it made sense at the time, went after a structure that was about cost and efficiency was the primary design principle.
Right.
So lots of shared services within a matrix. But if you think about a software product and the life cycle of it, you know, the idea, the design, the building, the testing and the deploying of it, and then the evolution of it till the day it's retired. Each of those steps of that life cycle was owned by a different shared service group. And so end-to-end accountability for the actual product or service was really impossible to find unless you got a committee of leaders together and you said, okay, we as a group of five own this end-to-end, but you know, who's up first? And so, you know, aligned with my personal values, but also our company's cultural values, two of which are about accountability and empowerment. One thing, again, we did very, very early on is break up the shared service groups and look at the three constituencies we serve. We serve guests to restaurants, so we'll have a team built around the guest. We serve franchisees and what we call sandwich artists, but the people who make the sandwich and the frontline workforce. We're going to build a team around that constituency. And then we have our employees and our corporate infrastructure. We're going to build a team around that constituency. And so we really simplified the organization into what we call three pillars, guest, franchisee, employee, and then left one shared service supporting all three, which is infrastructure and operations, which is networking, cloud management, DevOps, those sorts of things. But to the greatest extent we could afford to do it, we created teams that managed end-to-end, had all of the resources, financial and human resources and tooling to manage their products, their product delivery, their product support. And then, of course, if something goes bump in the night and it breaks, you know, the guy who designed or the gal who designed it and built it is also the one who'll get the experience of fixing it. And that makes them stronger in terms of design and build. And people like the end-to-end accountability because they can point at something they delivered, you know?
Well, and it gives you it gives you a purpose because you're not just doing your little cog in the wheel and then moving on. You're actually involved. It's essentially the product management approach that has gone on in digital. And I know I found that when I was doing some research for our show today, you were talking about this back in 2015, product management approach and how good it is for IT. I think it's been one of the really important drivers moving technology executives and teams in general into more strategic, kind of deeply embedded in the business. That's what I've seen just watching outside and across a very big and rambling industry as we have. The tech team being so relatively new. And you had mentioned that when we talked earlier that when you arrived, there were more than 90 different IT projects in motion. And what did you do about that? I know now you're probably down to more like 40. Are they now all part of what the fourth pillar does, the shared services? Or did you end up essentially transferring those into more of a product management approach?
Yeah, look, each of the three pillars is in a little bit of a different place. So our digital, our consumer guest digital pillar is very much in a product management approach, essentially a full expression of agile principles and techniques. And you know, got a good deal of autonomy, authority, and they're working constantly with guest insights, guest feedback, and they're iterating and deploying changes to our apps, our websites, our loyalty programs, our digital assets every month. So they're on a cadence where it's constant change, constant refresh every month. You know, the restaurant tech group, we have, for example, our own point of sale system. We designed it, we built it, it's quite unusual. It's a massive asset for us because it's built for Subway, by Subway.
Yes.
If I need to, and in the restaurant industry, that point of sale is the central nervous system of the brand and the operations. If we need to do something different, a commercial strategy, Mary Fran, and I need to change the point of sale, I'm not going to point of sale vendor queuing up and hoping that in 12 months time they can deliver.
Right.
You know, we have our team in Miami and we have a quarterly point of sale release. So every quarter we're adjusting and refreshing, you know, the in-restaurant technology. So they're on a different cadence because that level of change into the restaurants takes a different training approach, a different communication approach than constantly iterating on your app or your website.
Yeah.
And then you've got, you know, the corporate kind of, I'll call it back office area, where we have an agile mindset, but we may still do some waterfall style execution.
Sure.
You know, because upgrading your general ledger is something you can actually plan in a waterfall fashion, and it makes more sense to run it as a waterfall project. And so I would say we're a hybrid as to how we work, and we let each of those pillars situationally. I'm not a fan of one size fits all.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I think forcing standardization sub-optimizes areas of the business, but we want to be thoughtful about where we're different. And I think we have been thoughtful about where we're different and how we work a little bit different. That fourth group that I mentioned, the shared service group, they support all of the efforts of those other pillars because, you know, whether we're running our finance application in the cloud or we're running our native digital app in the cloud, it's still the cloud. We shouldn't need multiple folks managing multiple clouds.
Yeah. Are you, is the business moving, let's talk about the tech a little bit more now. Is the business moving significantly toward cloud-based wherever it makes sense? Or do you have a particular approach to, you know, considering cloud or, you know, as I mentioned, the service desk management software, that kind of thing? How are you going about providing all those digital-based services now? What are kind of some of the highlights of how you've been approaching that?
Yeah, I mean, going forward, we wouldn't do on-premise compute anymore. We still have a captive data center, a co-location facility, but directionally, everything as it's upgraded or replaced is either going to a commercial SaaS product that we would leverage. And so, you know, our preference in many areas of our business is to leverage commercial software, but it would be SaaS. We wouldn't run it on-prem, obviously. In the digital space, the digital consumer space, and as I mentioned around point of sale and menu and what I call the secret sauce of running our restaurants, that we're very comfortable owning. We'll design it, we'll develop it, we'll support it. It'll be custom fit to Subway's needs. We can pivot fast because we've got the people, the engineers on our teams. That's kind of how we think about it. And they're all built on cloud and they've all migrated. So, you know, for example, I talked about our digital platforms crashing, not being able to scale, you know, back
in 2019.
You know, through 2020 and 2021, we redesigned all our digital channels in North America, but we also rebuilt our APIs. The APIs are really the gating factor as to how much traffic and volume you can push through the digital channels. And we, you know, we did the right things. Microservices, go to serverless compute on, you know, we use both AWS and Azure. So, but you know, scalable serverless computing infrastructure, microservices. We now have a digital platform, and we've tested for this, that could run a $14 billion digital business.
Oh, interesting.
So dimensionally, when we started the journey in 2020, we were at about $600 million digital business. We're today over $2 billion. We can go to 7x today's with the existing infrastructure and architecture that we've built over the last couple of years. We can go, we're about a approaching $17 billion brand. Our, mm-hmm. our point of sale and our infrastructure, in-restaurant infrastructure, can take us to 8 times that.
Wow. Okay.
So we've built very, very scalable architectures, and that's great because we're growing fast again. We need that.
Well, and that must be a very compelling story that you get to share when you meet with these different PE companies.
They're really excited because what I can tell them, and I do tell them, is the investment and the heavy lifting in building a good experience in digital, the guests really like, we get great guest mm-hmm. feedback, a very scalable platform that we can now take around the rest of the world, because everything I've just talked about, we've done for North America.
Yes.
But what we also inherited was those APIs were built for North America without an eye towards international expansion. So in refactoring the APIs, we're also able to internationalize them. And okay. so this notion now that we've got, and for a potential buyer, you have a highly scalable, successful digital platform in the US that you can now take to Europe, you can take to Asia, you can take to Latin America. And, you know, because the digital business is more profitable for the franchisee, average order size is higher because people upsell themselves when they're on an app or a website.
I know. We've talked about that before.
When someone asks you in the restaurant, do you want to add a bag of chips or a drink? You know, your initial reaction subconsciously is to hesitate or say no. In the digital channels, typically the average order is about 20% higher. So it's a massive win for the franchisee. It's obviously mm-hmm. better for the guest, easier access, more convenient. And the fact that we've built the platform and we don't have to invest a lot to take it around the world, it's really exciting for us and for potential owners. You know?
Yeah, I remember talking about this with you a couple of years ago when you were still with Bloomin Brands, that no guilt factor, you know, when you're standing in line, if you're doing it on your mobile app, nobody's going to know, you know, nobody's going to give you the stink eye if you order a bag of chips.
Yeah.
I remember too, you've always been very, of course, customer focused, but customer focused and adding data to it, experiments and experiential. I remember us having a conversation once about trying those touch screens in the airport restaurant branches of probably Bloomin Brands, and thinking it was going to do really well, and then discovering that it was a different kind of customer who didn't want to mess around with something at the table. What have you seen about the digital behavior of customers today? What is kind of the most updated view about what customers do and don't want on their digital apps?
Well, look, they want the fewest clicks. So, you know, we obsess about conversion rate. In fact, the ultimate measure is sales, obviously. You know, so you grow to a $2 billion digital business and, you know, we see our path to at least doubling that over the next 3 years. So you've sales, you've got conversion rate. So if you come to our app or our website, you know, what percent of the time do I convert you into a sale? They're key metrics for us. And our customers want simplicity. But in Subway, it's a particular challenge because the brand was built on the notion you walk in and you have a full palette of ingredients, meats, cheeses, vegetables, sauces, breads. And you're asked, in fact, 11 questions.
Each one is a decision factor. I know.
Do you want it toasted? Meat? Mm-hmm. Do you want double meat? Cheese? So it's 11 to 12 questions to build a sub. And online or in an app, how do you make that really simple?
Yeah.
You can go so far with the technology. But the other thing we're doing, because all our strategies connect, is in the better food pillar, we're moving to what we call the Subway series. So now there's going to be two ways to order your Subway.
Oh, good.
You can still answer 11 questions, design and build, you know, the Merry Friend special, whatever that would be.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can look at the menu board just as you would in most QSRs and say, I'll have a number one or a number three. You know, I'm going to have the great garlic. I'm going to have the monster meat, whatever. These sandwiches, the series sandwiches, they're pre-built, chef designed. Everything works perfectly in harmony. It's great. Mm-hmm. It's craveable. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of one click order.
Yes. Right? Yes.
Not 20 questions, not 12 questions.
Yes.
And incidentally, what we know from our guest research, and this plays into our strategies,
mm-hmm.
is guests are not great at designing their perfect sandwich. They think they are. But for example, people like pickles, people like olives, they'll tend to put them both onto the same sandwich. They really don't work together. They're a bad flavor combination.
Yeah.
Or you're someone like me and you do a ham, cheese, lettuce, tomato, and it's like, well, I could make that at home. There's nothing inspiring about that, right?
Okay.
And so we're moving people, as we shift the menu and we shift the operating model, it actually plays into this digital convenience and access. Right. And guests really, really like that.
Well, and I've seen that idea that you can build your own or you can pick one of the four. There's a big salad bar at one of the major grocery chains here.
Yes.
I live near Boston and I tend to go, I'll take the Greek salad and, you know, extra pickles or whatever. It's so much easier. I think that that taps into a, you know, a that human desire not to be overwhelmed by too many choices.
Yeah.
You
know, the way we will have to get there in the end is personalization, which is an overused term. But personalization for us will come, and we're into this right now, really studying the guest data. And obviously, we apply machine learning and AI to a degree because they're big data sets.
Mm-hmm.
But really understanding Mary Fran, how she uses the brand, why she uses the brand, more context about Mary Fran than just her interaction with Subway.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, taking your first party data and marrying it up to, you know, data we can get from third parties about you in terms of your lifestyle, your interests, your life stages. When we build out that full profile of Mary Fran,
mm-hmm.
we can, you know, first of all, market to you in a much more relevant way. Hit you with a message that resonates, hit you with an offer that'll activate you.
Yeah.
We're not there today. We have the data, but we haven't built the activation yet. We're in the middle of building that activation stack.
Mm-hmm.
But also importantly, when you then come to the app or the website or an in-restaurant kiosk, we can recognize you. And not ask you, if you're someone who likes to build your own, we'll take you down to build your own path. If you're someone who likes to order off the Subway series menu, we'll suggest your favorite sandwich first. And we just take clicks and take, it's taking friction out.
Okay.
It's a constant battle to take out friction. The beauty of it and why you're never going to get bored with this work is every day we've improved, our competitors have improved.
I was just thinking about that there are
everybody ups their game all the time and we're all fighting. You know, we were behind, I would say 2 or 3 years ago, we were behind. We're not anymore. We're now right in the middle of that competitive set. Mm-hmm. You know, our digital properties are very, very competitive, but every month we're watching our guests, but we're watching our competitors and we're evolving.
Yeah. And is this for the restaurant industry in general, is this still a version of that Amazon factor? I mean, a lot of us started doing this on Amazon a couple of years ago where they'd say, oh, other people that bought this particular also bought these. You know, they were offering other options to you. It goes on almost to an excessive degree now.
Yeah.
But is this the restaurant version of that happening or is this a different effect?
Look, I think it's the same. It's the same basic notion of taking the data that your consumers have shared with you, if they're in a loyalty program, or even if they're just paying electronically and they're not in a loyalty program, you have a sparser data set. Taking that data and using it to make it easier for the consumer to interact with the brand and get what they want from the brand. Mm-hmm. So whether you call it the Amazon effect or not, I mean, we're not doing ratings and reviews and, you know, if you like this sandwich, other people who bought that sandwich bought this. That's not what we're after.
Okay.
Explicitly in front of you, but as we serve up a message, or ultimately as we serve up a path through our digital ordering, we'll have studied that data so as we give you the right message or the right path.
Yeah. Yeah. Does this, as you're heading into the rest of this year and then into 2024, what sort of, what do you have going on kind of the edge of these innovations that you could talk about, that you could tell us what's coming, say for your loyalty program or something more innovative that we should all be looking for in the Subway stores?
Well, look, every year we internally have a focal point for our whole brand across all of the five strategies. We call it the big refresh.
Okay.
And so big refresh 1.0, which was, we ran the year I got here, a couple of months after I got here, was about improving the ingredients in the sandwich unit. Mm-hmm. Better meats, better cheeses, better breads. Mm-hmm. That was the first refresh. Big refresh last year was these custom-built Subway Series, new menu, yes, chef-inspired, yes, craveable sandwiches. Big refresh this year will center on bringing slicers to our restaurants. So freshly sliced meat in the restaurant. We're the only major sandwich player who hasn't been slicing in the restaurant. And we actually pay more to slice it upstream and deliver it sliced than we will slicing it freshly. So there's a guest win and there's an economic win for the franchisee. We're super excited about that. So that'll be the centerpiece of what you'll see on media in July. Mm-hmm. Our big refreshes are always in July. You'll see the media. We use a lot of sports personalities to bring our message. Mm-hmm. But hot on the heels of big refresh 3.0 is a brand new loyalty program. So we have a loyalty program in the US.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, I know that you have plans for that.
27, 28 million members. So it's a meaningful size program. It's a meaningful database. It's a little hard to understand and it's not compelling in terms of value to the guests. So we did a lot of research. Mm-hmm. We've redesigned the program. We've upgraded the technology. We're right in the middle of testing the new, you know, in-app, in-web kind of user experience, the face of the program. Mm-hmm. And we launched that in Q3 this year. And then in parallel with that, we're doing a major customer data platform initiative, you know, finding Mary Fran, building out the full profile of Mary Fran, and then mining that data to look for other people like Mary Fran and what drives you, what are your propensities, what makes you come to Subway, how do we understand how to treat you in a way that's good for you. So that personalization program will also start in Q3. So new loyalty program, then taking the data and instead of general messages and generic offers, personalization. And then the big unlock for us later this year will be taking all of these, the channels, the digital channels, the new loyalty program, the customer data platform and the personalization, the marketing activation capabilities, and bringing them into Europe. So we're going into Finland first.
Okay.
Finland is going to be the Subway gold standard for digital experience.
Interesting.
We're going to put everything in there. It's a highly digitally savvy
country. Yes.
Culture. Mm-hmm. And it's also, when I went there, it was interesting. I learned an expression called social convenience.
Oh, okay.
And social convenience in that context is the Finns don't like to talk a lot. You know,
they go into
a restaurant, they don't want to answer 12 questions.
Yes, they are a taciturn.
They do like to interact digitally. And, you know, let's face it, younger generations all around the world are like that.
Yeah.
And so in Finland, we'll also, it'll be the first market where we put in self-ordering kiosks in the restaurant so that you don't even have to go up to the sandwich unit. You just order on a big screen. If you don't have the app, you can order on a big screen and then wait for your name to show up on the board and then take your bag and go.
Yeah. Have you found as a person, as a CIO in the restaurant business for a long time, is that different between generations? Because I can, that ability to go and use the kiosk, I can remember some months ago, it was probably maybe a year and a half ago, and the pandemic had finally eased around the Boston area. And I went into, well, the number one brand above your number two brand is McDonald's. Yeah. And yes, I remember going in there and seeing, and there was no one at the counters and it was all kiosks. And I felt like such a little old lady. I thought, is this a problem with being a boomer? You know, because I wasn't exactly sure what to do. So do you run into that? May be my own, you know, problem that I need to work on. But
I would tell you, for me, Mary Fran, it's much more about the geography. So in Western Europe, kiosks are ubiquitous and people of all ages use them and are comfortable with them. Mm-hmm. You know, my parents are in their mid-80s. I go home to Ireland to visit them. Mm-hmm. They pay with everything on their phone. They don't carry a credit card. They just use Apple Pay for everything. They're super comfortable with it. Yeah. So I think a lot of it is the geography and the context. If you go around Western Europe, you go around Australia, New Zealand, you go around certain parts of the world, you cannot go into a fast food restaurant and not see a kiosk.
Okay.
They're ubiquitous. North America is very different. You know, in certain settings, we believe kiosks are going to work well here for certain consumers. And over time, I think we'll get there. Mm-hmm. But it reminds me a bit of payments. Remember when EMV came and we had to go kind of chip and signature?
Yes.
Europe had done EMV for 20 years before we did.
That's true. And probably in the Asian countries, they probably had it 5 years before.
In Asian countries, they pay by face or by biometrics. So as great as we are at inventing technologies, getting them into the hands and the habits of consumers, we're a little slower.
Yeah. Well, and fair enough. I'll try to, I've just been kind of embarrassed about that whole experience after it happened to me. I actually went out to my car. I gave up. I went out to my car and I just drove home and made myself a sandwich. And I thought,
try the Subway app and we'll take care of you.
I tell you what, I downloaded it yesterday and found out that I've got 3 Subway stores within a 10-minute drive. Not even 10 minutes. So I'm definitely going to try it because I'll know exactly who to go to if I have any problems, right?
Exactly. Your own personal help desk.
Yes, exactly. You had mentioned a few times we made glancing reference to the 5 big turnaround strategies, and we've talked about them in bits and pieces, but I just want to make sure we run through them. The one is the better food. The 2 is better service and restaurant excellence. 3, digital revolution, which we talked about a good deal. And then 4 and 5 are compelling value and dynamic development from our list. So the compelling value, that's the DNA of a brand that is fresh and accessible. Talk through numbers 4 and 5 so we be sure we cover them.
Well, compelling value, we have a value advantage. So we compete with the burger guys, the chicken guys, we compete with all the fast food at the lower price points. And then we also compete with the Jersey Mike's, the Firehouse Subs, the Jimmy John's, who tend to be higher price points. So we like our position in the middle of that spectrum. Mm-hmm. And we can take share from both the sandwich competitors and the burger, the chicken competitors. We like that, but compelling value then means you need to run a lean organization. You need to make wise investments. You need to be a good steward of capital. Yeah. So we're very, very focused on that. We've got the scale to be compelling value. I mean, when you're running nearly 40,000 restaurants and you're sourcing, you know, whether it's a point of sale hardware or it's chicken, our flour. I mean, our sourcing advantage means we've got to maintain that position. So we continue to do that. And as a CIO, I continue to work on strategies to make us more efficient. And then, you know, dynamic development is really two. Actually, it's a handful of strategies. They're interesting. One is obviously you got to refresh the restaurants. That decade of drift, leadership drift, we let our restaurants get old and tired. About 50% of the restaurants in the U.S. have now been refreshed, but we've still got 10,000 to go. So, got to finish that task. Design the restaurant of the future. We're in the middle of that. So, we need less space for people to sit down and eat a sandwich. We need more space for people to grab and go. We may need, we will need different tech in the restaurants to enable a business when it becomes 30% digital instead of 15%. So we'd probably go like Chipotle, have a, you know, a second production line where you've got one producing digital orders, one producing in-store orders. So that's dynamic development. And also dynamic development is internationally, we have about 14,000 restaurants internationally. Our fair share of international restaurant count would be more like 40,000 than 14,000. And we're doing that by selling markets to what we call master franchisees. So well-capitalized big restaurant operators who run, you know, for example, you sell a geography like in India and you have a development agreement where they're going to build a couple of thousand restaurants over a decade, right? And that's how you build it out internationally. So there's a lot going on in each of these strategies. I could probably spend 30 minutes on each of them, but the key is that they're mutually reinforcing.
Well, and that is when you have a, you know, several pillars around these strategies, and especially when you have all the communication between the different pillars and why it's there. 'Cause you had mentioned you often send out your tech team, they go on learning tours where they go out and they see things with their own eyes. And that reminds me not to let you go until you just share a few words of wisdom with us about what you've learned about your own leadership style over the last few years. You know, you tried to get away from the industry for a little while, but now you're back in it. And what do you want to pass along for other digital leaders?
Oh, I mean, it's all about people, for me. And look, the impact I can have is not clever technology design or being able to fix it, a technical problem. It's people. I was thinking before we had the call this morning. My first managerial job was in 1991 in the UK. An era and a geography that was very hierarchical, kind of long-range five-year plans created by leaders, handed down to the workers who would execute, you know, command
Very
and control
command and
top-down.
control, felt comfortable
And
to everybody.
what has completely flipped for me over those 3 decades is servant leadership, massive listening. And really walking in the shoes of your customer, be it your internal customer. If your internal customer is finance, go and close the books at the end of the month with them. In our case, you know, when I join a brand like Subway, I go and I work in the restaurant before I even come to the office. So
Did
on
you do
day one,
that
when
this
I
time
arrive at the
again too?
office, and when I arrive at the office on day one, I actually have something relevant to say about what it felt like to be a frontline worker and use our processes and use our tools. So that's kind of instant credibility, but also helps you then focus the team on what makes a difference. And it's really about creating an environment for those teams to be successful. If you've got the right people, your job is create the environment.
And if you've got the right people and you've created that kind of environment, those people will help you keep recruiting others like them. You know,
Exactly.
that's you create the
And
team
they'll come up
culture.
with the good ideas and the great strategies. It takes the pressure off of you, you know?
Well, and I always thought one of the things I've seen you quoted on a few times where you say, you know, and we just glancingly mentioned the importance of data, but one time you said, without data, you're just another person with an opinion.
Yes.
So I just,
that's one of my favorite quotes.
I know.
Deming,
yes.
My hero.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, wonderful. It's been so great having you here today. And didn't I tell you this hour would fly by incredibly quickly? Was I lying?
No, you were correct.
All right. All right.
It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. It is a pleasure to catch up with you again. And I, you know, if I get a personal vote, I never want you to retire and just sail away in St. Petersburg. I think you should stay in the thick of things because you have all, I think that's true with all of our Hall of Fame members, that you have a lot to offer to the various industries. And I'm just glad you're in the thick of it again with Subway. And I wish you all the best. And I'm going to check out the app and I'll be watching. So thank you so much. Good. For joining
well,
me
nice
today.
Nice to see you today, Mary Fran.
Yes. Now, if you joined us late today and you're thinking to yourself, that looked like a great conversation. Well, you're right about that, but you don't have to worry. We will have this posted on LinkedIn on our CIO.com area on LinkedIn throughout today. And then it will be available on our CIO YouTube channel. And Leadership Live also shows up as an audio podcast wherever you find your podcasts. And I hope that you enjoyed and learned from today's conversation with Donna Herlihy as much as I did. He is the Chief Digital and Information Officer at Subway. We'll be returning to you on Wednesday, June 21st, when I'm going to have a special doubleheader episode built around women's leadership in technology. And we're going to be featuring Julia Anderson, who is the CIO of Campbell Soup. And she is also going to be joined by Kristen Lamoureux, who is the founder of the SIM Women Executive IT Networking Organization that is part of the Society of Information Management. So it's going to be a fabulous show with the ladies 2-3 weeks from now. And we thank you for joining us today. And a special thanks again to our sponsor for this episode, IT service management provider, Topdesk. Please take a moment to subscribe to CIO's YouTube channel, where you can find more than 100 of these very highly bingeable CIO Leadership Live shows. It was great having you here today. Stay well, and we'll see you next time.